You are listening to Radio Aryan for an alternative to the anti-white system. On RadioAryan.com.
I think they're getting out of hand. Well, you know what happened to those who complain. We've got to stop them seeing light. Let them think it's all right, 'cause the fireworks aren't to keep them entertained. Well, the wells have not run dry. Do we really need to lie? We'll say it's a national emergency. We'll set a wedding full of clowns, and we'll kick them while they're down. Get the banks control, 'cause they are to me. Let's go and find a better place. We'll call it New America. Won't it be a lovely place to be? Imperial material, the mind of New America, the best idea since democracy.
Hello and welcome once again to The Rope Report, Billy's Balkanization Podcast, brought to you every Wednesday at 3 p.m. Central Time, right here on RadioAryan.com, by the letters 14 and 88, and by the letter H. This week on The Rope Report, as you may have noticed, I did not do my normal intro, which formerly has been, "Welcome, ladies and gentlemen and children of all ages," because that's been copied by more and more podcasts and radio shows throughout the alt-right and white nationalist genre. So that's no longer really mine. I didn't have a trademark or a copyright on it, so I'll let that intellectual property drift away, and we'll just say that we'll bring you news and entertainment from a political perspective just to the right of Dr. Joseph Mengele. And then when someone starts copying that, then we'll move on as well, because we do maintain the honed knife cutting edge, the tip of the spear, not the shaft of the blade, as others do, often imitated but never duplicated. This is The Rope Report. Now, on last week's The Rope Report, we actually had three other people, two phone interviews by Chris Quimby, the co-director of the Shieldwall Network, and Tom Kaczynski, the founder of the New Albion white ethnostate in Upper New England, as well as an audio presentation of Mike Enoch Pinovich's self-description of himself as being partially Jewish. And I did, as I expected, get a lot of backlash from TRS and Daily Shoah LOL Bergs, who said that it was out of context, that Mike Enoch really didn't mean to say that he always referred to Jews as Jude, even among other Jews, using that word. And he didn't really mean to say that if people took a purist stance to the white nationalist movement, then that would mean that everyone who was mixed race Jewish would have to go, and in that case, he would have to go. But that there were some mixed race Jews who were the only ones who could be allowed in the white nationalist movement, who had earned that place, and he felt, in his case, that he did. Now, whenever I'm confronted with these people who are in abject denial of the man's own words, I ask them very clearly, in what other possible context could one take the admission that he himself is a part Jew, and that if one takes a purist stance, then he would have to go, but that if mixed-race Jews were able to earn their way into the white nationalist movement, then they could stay, and he believes that in his case, he did. He verbatim says that, and there's no way that that can be taken in any other context other than in his own words. And then I ask them, is it true that he married a Jewess, and then lied to everyone by presenting her as a white woman and using her in the Daily Show as skits about the Holocaust. And not just that she was a Jewess, but she was a self-conscious Jew, a very liberal, leftist, anti-white Jew who was in on the joke. It's not like they were ignorant of the fact that Jews are not white, and perhaps they thought that Jews were just another ethnicity of white. It was a purposeful obfuscation. It was a purposeful deception of his listeners. Also, divorce records are public, and no one can produce any divorce records showing that they have actually been divorced. But be that as it may, people who believe in Mike Enoch Pinovich either seriously don't care whether he is Jewish or not. They seriously don't care if he's married to a Jewess or not. They don't believe that purity spiraling is beneficial. They don't believe that ethnicity or genes or race really matters because they're not very serious about this and they won't be around 5 years from now. It's all LARPing. It's all just LOL-berging. It's all just a joke. And none of them are really going to matter in the long run. But my purpose in exposing his lies over and over again is to save some people the financial and emotional hardship of being deceived and lied to. But more importantly, you know, one of the biggest black pills, one of the things that depresses and frustrates people who are new to our movement is finding out that, well, some of the people they have faith in initially are not quite what they thought they were. A lot of people drop out of the movement, and it becomes a revolving door for a lot of disappointing reasons. They think that, you know, because we're all self-centered, we all see life as being an action movie that we are the star of. They think that because they're involved in the movement now, definitely in 6 months we should be in the White House. We should have control over the world because they're the star of the show in their own mind. Reality is, political struggles and revolutions don't actually work that way. And some people, because they don't get immediate gratification of the kind which they've been bred and raised to expect, they don't get a participation trophy just for showing up. No one is really holding their breath to hear their opinion, even though, by God, they're very, very happy and willing to share it. I mean, all of us know those people who get involved in the movement and they're sure now that victory is just months away. And because they are now involved, they know exactly what everyone else has been doing wrong for the last 40 years. And they know exactly how to win. They've got the ideas. And not only do they have the ideas, they think that you should implement those ideas. There are a lot of idea people. And very few nuts and bolts workers, very few actual boots on the ground, grease on the knuckles activists who are willing to implement their ideas or anyone else's. Everyone wants to be a chief and no one wants to be an Indian, right? Well, it doesn't really matter whether anyone believes me or believes Vin Longshanks or believes Mike Enoch Pinovich himself in his own words about whether or not he is Jewish. It doesn't matter whether anyone really believes that his wife is Jewish. It doesn't matter whether anyone really believes that he lied to everyone about his wife being Jewish and used her on the show. It doesn't matter whether anyone really believes that his half-brother is a mulatto, mixed race, part black. It doesn't really matter at all because those people don't matter. They're not serious. It's just entertainment to them, and none of them are willing to put any skin into the game as the rest of us have. So, that was my point last week, whenever I used the Sesame Street theme song, which some of us in what they call WN 1.0, but those of us who are Generation X just remember as being, you know, our childhood, the Sesame Street theme song of One of these things is not like the other. I sandwiched in an interview with Chris Quimby, who's been a friend of mine and a fellow activist for over 20 years through several different organizations, and who has participated in more in real life protests and demonstrations and rallies than these kids in the alt-right have actually been alive a number of years. And with Tom Kaczynski, the founder of New Albion, recently fired for his privately stated political and racial views from his job as the town manager of Jackman, Maine. He's now become an open advocate for white civil rights and a white nationalist leader and spokesman. And I juxtaposed those two people whom I have utmost respect for with Mike Enoch Pinovich. And that then is why I chose the Sesame Street theme song for the little game. One of these things is not like the other. One of these things just does not belong. Can you guess which thing is not like the other? And the majority of my listeners could. Of the several hundred people who have already listened to last week's The Roper Report podcast, 2/3, almost 70%, agreed with me about Mike Enoch Pinovich. And that's based on the thumbs up and thumbs down on YouTube, as well as on listener feedback through email and private messages and instant messaging through social media. So, I'll take that. You know, that's pretty good odds. And if some people still want to follow the majority, well, they can listen to MSNBC or to CNN or to the Daily Show if they want to continue to send their shekels into the Jewish-controlled media, one way or the other. Now, speaking of the Jewish-controlled media, this last week, there was an article in Mother Jones, the online edition, which was written by a Jew named Schatz. And Schatz wrote this article called "The Terrifying Rise of Alt-Right Fight Clubs." The terrifying rise of alt-right fight clubs. I guess he was going for the emotional hyperbole, or maybe he was really scared. He wrote about alt-right and white nationalist fight clubs in Russia and in Germany and here in the United States. And after he talked about how scary these white nationalists were who were learning how to physically defend themselves, learning some martial arts and some hand-to-hand combat, and actually using them in the ring, then he talked about me. I guess the idea of white nationalists beating up each other and learning how to defend themselves so they could beat up the Antifa wasn't scary enough. He had to throw in the fact that one of those alt-right fight clubs here in the United States was, according to Schatz, the Jew, guilty of guilt by association because they were associated with Billy Roper, whom the SPLC says is the uncensored voice of violent neo-Nazism, he said. So I guess that just having an alt-right or white nationalist fight club is not scary enough, even though he used the adjective terrifying in the title of his article. Being associated with me is even worse for them. Well, Schatz and other Jews are right to be terrified. They are right to be afraid, but maybe not for exactly the reasons that he thinks. It's not going to be direct action so much that they need to be afraid of, but this implacable, inevitable force of nature, this evolution of social dysfunction that Jews like himself have actually put into motion. You see, the Balkanization, the breakup of the United States, is a result of Jews promoting whites becoming a minority and open borders and homosexuality and all the other destructive things they have tried to do to make us a minority and to create polarization and division in this country to protect themselves, because it's the Jewish adaptive survival strategy that they learned through 109 times of being kicked out of every country they ever parasitically infested over and over and over again. So they learned that if they undermined the majority, if they tried to destroy homogeneity, if they pushed for immigration and open borders, if they tried to destroy traditional values and morals and ethics, then they were less likely to be pogromed. They were less likely to be pointed out as the other, if they were not the only minority, if they were just one of several minorities all squabbling for their slice of the pie in a multiracial cacophony where there was no single majority. So that's why Jews always work to destroy the majority of any host nation they go into. It's their learned survival adaptive strategy. And what that means for the United States of America is that as this nation state ends and Balkanization comes, there'll be the rise of new white ethnostates. And at the end of these epochs, there's always a huge backlash against the destroyers of civilization and nations. And the new white ethnostates will not have any place for Jews like Schatz. And it won't be because of alt-right or white nationalist fight clubs. And it won't even be because of people like me not having our sentiments censored. It'll be because the common people, the salt of the earth, will have had enough. And they will string up the last Jew with the last entrails of their last race traitor. And ultimately, the end of Jewish rule over whites in North America, the end of Jewish hegemony over the United States will come when the United States ceases to exist. Like every too successful parasite, the Jews have just about succeeded in killing off their host. But in that rotting corpse, they'll find no place to hide and nothing to sustain them. They will die along with that host, or they'll have to flee to another. And ultimately, Jews like Schatz know somewhere deep in the greasy, dirty, dark corners of their souls that they've done this to themselves. But they just can't help it. It's their chutzpah. It's their arrogance, their hubris. Over and over and over again, they do this. In nation after nation, over 109 times, but we use the number 109 just because it makes a good meme. It's a good symbolic number. But they've been doing this for centuries, folks. And ultimately, as communication becomes more global and the world becomes smaller through travel, at some point, we're going to have to finish the job. But until then, we can look forward to the Jews' successful destruction of the United States of America leading to their demise on this continent. And they are, as Shakespeare wrote, going to be hoisted on their own petard. They did it to themselves. They have no one to blame but themselves. They might kvetch and moan about evil whites, how hard the goyim are on them. But the truth is, deep down, they know they deserve it. They already do. So, when you hear about neo-Nazism from the SPLC or the ADL, both of which have published articles about myself and the Shilwell Network over the last week, remember that these Jews in both these organizations and throughout the controlled media know what's coming. And what's more important, they know they deserve it. They are scared witless because they just do not know when that other shoe is going to drop. And their self-awareness, their guilt, is really almost pathetic because they cannot help themselves. It's almost like a compulsion. It's an inborn instinct now, this group adaptive survival trait that they developed. And they're, in some cases, not even conscious of it, but they know. They know how this is going to end. Now, myself being a Christian identist,
I've been able to flip forward to the back of the book, and I know that ultimately we are going to win. I read how it's going to end. I read Revelations 2:9 and Revelations 3:9, and I know as well as they do what is coming for them. But for those who have not yet read, and those who have not seen that train rolling down the track, let me give you the biggest white pill of all. We will win. Now, along the way toward that ultimate victory in the war, we may lose a battle or two, and that will help us to hone our skills and to strengthen our courage and our resolve. It will also help to weed out the weak, the LARPers, the LOLbergs, who are not really in it, who are not putting any skin in the game, who are just playing. It'll separate the wheat from the chaff. It'll separate the men from the boys. And as things get closer and closer to the pivot point, to the crisis event scenario, which will kick everything off, it's going to get harder. It's going to get tougher. It's going to get more serious and scarier. And a lot of these players are going to leave the game. And that's fine. That also is a natural evolution, along with the competition, which so many people call infighting. And I don't punch right. I only punch left. And that's because I can't see anybody to my right. There's nothing to my right except for the wall. So all these people that I criticize are only to my left. That being said, Hitler did not punch right when he did the Night of the Long Knives, or when he absorbed the Freikorps, or when he put the SS over the Wehrmacht. Infighting is otherwise known as natural selection and healthy competition. There was infighting between the Federalists and the Anti-Federalists among our founding fathers. If you want to look at infighting, look at Alexander Hamilton and Aaron Burr. There's an example of infighting for you. Most of the founding fathers did not like each other personally, did not agree with each other politically, and could barely even stand to be in the same room together. And when they weren't in the same room, they backbit, and they gossiped, and they attacked one another, and they tried to undermine one another, and they formed cliques and coalitions with shifting memberships. People forget or are ignorant of history, and so they only see the infighting going on in their immediate environs, in the moment, and it seems really depressing and frustrating. And they had this idea of unity that, oh, if we could all just join together under one big umbrella organization, we could have victory tomorrow. Reality is, that's not how natural selection works. You do not make yourself stronger by shackling yourself to a cripple. You do not make yourself smarter by forming a committee between yourself and three retards. Natural selection means that survival of the fittest, survival of the best adapted, that requires some losers. And that requires some struggle, some conflict, and some competition. So I keep telling people to not worry so much about infighting and to not really crave unity so much. It's really overrated. Things are going to happen as they are supposed to happen, and ultimately, it will work and we will win. It's kind of like in the white nationalist movement. You know, there are some people who believe in ethnostates, and some people believe in an ethnostate after the balkanization of America, who literally believe that there is only one possible ethnostate, only one potential solution to our troubles, only one area of the country that all whites should migrate to and leave the rest behind. And it doesn't even matter whether they are right or wrong about that particular area that they're so gung-ho about. It's not the case that we have to even debate whether it's smart to try to get all the racially conscious whites into one quarter of the country, which is the most liberal area of the country, which is turning bluer and bluer every day as it becomes more and more liberal and left-wing, and which faces what will be, in the absence of American military power as a superpower, a Chinese lake. What is more important is this idea that only one person can be right, and that everyone else should fall into line behind them, and to spend all of their resources and assets and manpower forwarding that single idea, putting all their eggs in that one basket, proverbially speaking. I don't believe that there's only going to be one white ethnostate. I believe that there'll be several. And I don't require that I be correct or right about the place I'm living in. But I think that it's got a better shot at some, which people are enthusiastically cheerleading for, and just as good a shot as any other. And I'm talking, of course, about Ozarkia, which I've discussed before, and which you can read about by going to the Shieldwall Network website at arianwarrior.com. And you can read the Shieldwall Network plan, Project New America, there on that Shieldwall Network website. But whether I am right or whether I am wrong, it's not as important as the fact that people are trying to do something actively and not being stymied by those who say my way or the highway, or that there's only one salvation for the white race, only one potential white ethnostate. Of course not. North America is a huge place with many areas left that are over 90% white. And trying to dictate to everyone that they have to move to only one of those areas is really short-sighted and self-serving. Now, I would like to be able to say that, hey, I think that everything that I say on the Roper Report is crucial for you to hear, and that everyone should be required to listen to the Roper Report, Billy's Balkanization podcast, and also, you should all read all of my books. I have 14 published fiction and nonfiction books, and all 14 should be in each of your libraries. And, oh heck, I've got two editions of each. So, 28, all 28 should be in each of your libraries. Required reading. You should read it like scripture, day and night. And also, hey, I've got a birthday coming up this year, bet you didn't know. And my favorite sizes for your birthday presents to send in are 7.62 by 39 millimeter and 5.56 by 45 and 9 millimeter and 45 ACP. So please send in your donations and your contributions and your love offerings and send them to P.O. Box 1937, Mountain View, Arkansas, 72560. But it's not all about me. I don't have all the answers. And sometimes, like you guys, I don't even have the right questions. I try to do the best I can. We all do. But ultimately, in life, you know, we have to have faith in our fellow man that he's not always as stupid as we give him credit for being. I know that a lot of people who listen to my program are very intelligent and have a great deal of life experience, even if it's different life experience from mine, and a great deal of hard-won wisdom. And they may not all have the same kind of background or the same kind of education. Some may have academic education, and some may have street smarts, and some may have skills and resources and assets that are different from mine. But they have very legitimate worldviews, which are no more invalid than mine. And so that kind of communication, understanding, is necessary if we're going to try to understand each other enough to work together. And I can say, you know, that I have been wrong before and have admitted it and come to a better policy, a better understanding of what I need to be doing, a better tactic and strategy even. And I would hope that we all have enough maturity to also admit when we have some flaws in our plans. Or at least that someone else might have a perspective worth listening to. And so I would not say that it's only my way or the highway, and that my plan You know, Project New America, the Shieldwall Network plan, is the only plan that is right for you or for your family. But I do think that it's an alternative. And for those especially who are in Arkansas and the region around Arkansas, the adjoining states, or who would like to live in a white ethno state that is already forming naturally, organically, through voluntary internal migrations as people flee darkening areas of the Deep South and move into lightening, whitening areas of the Upper South, which are also the most conservative areas of the country, then, you know, it might be something that you should consider. But really, the paradox, and, you know, one of these guys actually refers to his paradoxes, but one of his paradoxes of organic migrants versus white nationalists is interesting, because if you think about what that is saying, it's that, you know, for the American colonists, the frontiersmen, the explorers, the pioneers who crossed an ocean in rickety, leaky wooden ships to come to a new wilderness and try to hack from that woods a civilization when it was populated by nothing but Stone Age savages beforehand. That organic migrants versus white nationalist push? Well, okay. It's a chicken or the egg type thing, isn't it? Do organic migrants become white nationalists as often as white nationalists become organic migrants? So think about those pioneers. Here's the analogy. The type of person who's willing to leave their fatherland or the motherland and cross an ocean and go to a new world are people who are either not successful in status quo, or they're rebellious against it. Maybe they're naturally more independent-minded, or they are so impoverished, or they're running from something, so they have nothing left to lose in the old country, so they come to the new. So you get this other dichotomy of colonists versus rebels. Now, the American colonists became rebels against the King of England and the Parliament and established a new country. Now, did they rebel because they were more likely to be rebellious because they left the father country to go to a colony? Did they rebel because, being colonists, they were geographically further distanced from the home country and the government? Independence and freedom, are they a cause or a result of geographic distance from the seat of power? Once again, the chicken and the egg. So, if you think about colonists going from the new country, from the old country to the new country, all right, and pioneers developing there, are they more likely to rebel because of geographic distance from their former government and the seat of power, or are they more likely to have removed themselves from proximity to that seat of power and that government because they were more rebellious? And then you have the loyalist who became Canadians, because even though they were far removed from the seat of power and government, they remained loyal to it. And that's why they are still more cucked and more authoritarian today than we in the States are, because they came from that heritage, literally, of being subservient to government, being loyalist. So, the chicken and the egg, the paradox of organic migrants versus white nationalists boils down to this. Right now, people are moving from Louisiana and Mississippi and southern Arkansas and from Texas to northern Arkansas, where I am, because they do not like their local communities turning black and brown. And some of them are willing to admit that that's why they're moving, and some use euphemisms like they move for the lower crime rates, the better schools, the clean mountain air, you know. The reality is they're moving to get away from niggers and spics and move to be around more white people. And it's having a snowball effect as it accelerates exponentially, creating this new ethnostate that's forming here in Ozarkia. But are they already white nationalists before they are organic migrants? Are they racially conscious before they act racially? Or when they move away from non-whites and then move to whites, does that create a feeling of white nationalism out of their organic migrancy? Because you see, people that you have to cajole and beg and browbeat and bribe and order to move to your area, they're not organic migrants. People that have to be told to move to one area of the country and reasoned with and have logical discussions and debates to convince to do so are not organic migrants. So some people are trying to get white nationalists to become organic migrants by trying to get white nationalists who are already racially conscious to move to a specific area of the country to form an ethnostate. I'm doing the reverse. I'm doing the exact opposite. I am taking organic migrants who are already voluntarily leaving their darkening areas and coming to my lightening, whitening area. I'm taking those organic migrants and turning them into white nationalists. And you know why that works? Because I don't have to sell them anything. It sells itself because they know in their heart why they have already moved, why they are here. They moved here to get away from niggers and spicks. And all you have to do is get through their denial to admit why they are here. Because they're already coming. They're already here. And that is real organic migrancy, which comes first. And then white nationalism is the acceptance, is the admission of what their own internal motivations were. So rather than trying to fight everyone else for the very limited pool of active white nationalists and to encourage them to move to my area, I am turning the organic migrants who are not yet white nationalists into us. And that's the difference between the chicken and the egg and between organic migrants and white nationalists. And that's the difference between colonists and rebels. So, independence and freedom is not a cause. It's a result of that voluntary organic migration that's going on. Now, when we talk about the founding of America and the origin of our nation, we were reminded this week by a comment by Nancy Pelosi. And she's a withered up old shrew, isn't she? She looks like a witch. Well, she wasn't very happy during the State of the Union address. You guys probably saw her glued to her seat and looking like she was chewing her cud. Maybe her dentures were getting loose or something. But she made a comment after Trump's State of the Union address where Pelosi said that it was obvious through his speech and his anti-immigration comments that he was trying to make America white again. Now, those colonists, those rebels who, you know, because of distance and lack of proximity to their seat of government and because of their own innate rebellious tendencies, they found this new government. They said explicitly, you know, Naturalization Act of 1790, that they were only going to accept white people as immigrants to and citizens of this new country, that they were establishing the government to secure the blessings of liberty for themselves and their posterity, not the posterity of Asia or Africa or Mexico. And to make sure that everyone was not confused, they doubled down 5 years later with the Naturalization Act of 1795, where they said, once again, even more explicitly, that you had to be a white person of good moral character in order to be a citizen of the new United States. And they did all this, you know, literally as they were ratifying the Bill of Rights to make the Constitution a thing. And so Pelosi, through her comments saying that, you know, Trump's anti-immigration stance and his base, his supporters' anti-immigration statements were to make America white again, reveals a couple of very interesting things. Think about this, folks. Number one, she's implicitly admitting that the United States of America was founded of, by, and for white people, and that it was a white nation, which completely undoes the liberal BS argument that we're a nation of immigrants and we were established to be a melting pot. Because in reality, these leftists know that our founding fathers were all white nationalists through their thoughts, through their words, and through their deeds. Most importantly, through their actions, IRL. The founding fathers were all white nationalists. By today's standards, and even by the standards of their own day. So, what Pelosi implicitly admits is that, yes, the United States was a white nation. And then secondly, through stating that it was to make America white again, she's admitting that she thinks that was a pretty sucky thing. That there's something wrong with being a white nation. Now, of course, there's nothing wrong with Nigeria or Kenya being black nations, or with Japan being an Asian nation, or with Israel, God forbid, being a Jewish nation. That's fine, hunky-dory. But there can be no such thing as a white nation in their mind. It's evil. We're not allowed. So Nancy Pelosi admits the United States of America was founded to be a white nation, and that that was a horrible thing. And that the idea that people might want to have a white nation is a horrible thing. Which is a pretty interesting statement for her to make, and instantly led to a lot of Democrats attacking her for it, saying that she should not make it about race. She just misspoke because she revealed a little bit too much truth. Speaking of revealing some truth, my comments, I've been asked, a lot of people are emailing in saying, Billy, when are you going to talk about this FISA memo? And what does this mean for us? So I'll take just a minute. Okay. The FISA memo basically was when the Obama administration, and specifically his Department of Justice, were ordered to, with the help of FBI Deputy Director McCabe and FBI Director Comey and Jews like Rod Rosenstein and the DOJ, to collude. Now, that's a word, collusion, that you've been hearing a lot. There wasn't really collusion between the Trump campaign and the Russians. The collusion was between the Obama administration and the FBI and the DOJ, the Department of Justice, to try to shut down the Trump campaign. Now, there's this British spy named Christopher Steele who was biased against Trump, left-wing liberal, who made up, he was desperate to keep Trump from getting elected, he made up incredible BS stories about salacious rumors, really, full of innuendo and things I won't even talk about in case there's some children listening. But this dossier that was created by ex-British spy Christopher Steele was used by the FBI as their only evidence to not only ask for, but to get warrants under FISA, under what we usually use to look into foreigners who might be in the U.S. operating against our nation's best interests, and to get these warrants to look after the Trump campaign and Trump campaign members to try to get dirt on them. It makes what happened with Richard Nixon and Spiro T. Agnew and Watergate look really tame by comparison. Over his 8-year administration, Barack Hussein Obama had top-loaded the Department of Justice and the FBI with left-wing liberals who bet on the wrong horse because they thought that Hillary would win and they thought they would never get caught and they'd never have to answer for their actions. And now they, lost. And so Comey is out. His chief of staff is out. Deputy director of the FBI is out. And now Rosenstein may be next. And the whole idea of this special prosecutor, Mueller, who was appointed by Rod Rosenstein, by the way, originally, has been investigating for a year, first trying to find collusion between the Trump campaign and the Russians, and then trying to find obstruction of justice where maybe someone in the Trump campaign or Trump himself tried to, through firing Comey, tried to stop the investigation. They have gotten nothing. But here's the deal. It does not matter. It's rearranging the deck chairs on the sinking Titanic, folks. Because what this reveals once again is that a civil war is coming to this country. It is inevitable and inescapable. We're not going to vote our way out of this mess. Donald Trump is not our guy. Even if he was, it does not matter. Look at the reaction from the left, from the Democrats, from liberals. Look at the reaction from the right, from the Trump campaign supporters, from the Trump base. They're completely, it's like they're looking at different documents, like they've read different memos. They're living in different realities. There's no common ground, no overlap for any kind of civil discussion. There's no rational discourse, no logical exchange. Everything is hyperbolic and emotional and very partisan. And not just, you know, jackass versus elephant partisan. Partisan in terms of red versus blue, right versus left, white versus everybody else. Because there's no rational discourse in saying, oh, you know what? This memo does look kind of bad. Or maybe this memo is not as bad as we were told. Everyone is spinning it just to reinforce their own preconceived notions and ideas of what it was going to say. And they're all trying to find a way to use it as ammunition to support their own side that they've already chosen. It's not changing anyone's mind about Trump or about Mueller or about the 2016 election at all. Not a single mind has been changed by this memo. It has only served to further polarize our country and divide it into warring camps who now actually see a constitutional crisis where if Trump fires Rosenstein or Mueller, the Democrats will say that he has challenged the Constitution. And regardless of what was in the memo, the Democrats would not have said, oh, you know what? I guess they did go after Trump a little hard. Maybe they did collude against him for Hillary, using the Fusion GPS funds to pay for, through the Democratic National Committee, Christopher Steele's fake dossier to try to get these FISA warrants on Trump's campaign, which is exactly what happened. Does not matter. Does not matter how much a shrimp cocktail cost once you've hit the iceberg. Titanic's going down, folks, so don't get caught up too much in it. Just look for these signposts along the way to civil war because the breakup of America is happening. And you can judge the speed at which it's going to go from a cold war into a hot war by these constitutional crises along the way. Now, one thing I want to talk about for the last 15 minutes is a program on YouTube, which I encourage you to all read. And as you read the description of this program on YouTube, you'll see that it's actually a TV miniseries from 1987 broken up into 13 parts. This is important to me because in 1987, I was in high school. I was a right-wing conservative, kind of a Republican-type Reagan Republican. But I was racially conscious. I just was using the Republican Party as an outlet. And you have to understand, for you millennials who are listening, that it was still in the Cold War. We literally believe that there's going to be a global thermonuclear war. We were still literally fighting communism. The Soviet Union was still a thing and still a global superpower. We did not have any way of knowing that 4 years later, 1991, that, you know, Mikhail Gorbachev would be the last premier of the Soviet Union, I guess the 82nd and the last, or that he would actually help dissolve the Soviet Union and hand over the nuclear launch keys to Russian President Boris Yeltsin, and that the USSR would turn to the CIS, the Commonwealth of Independent States, and then basically all the former republics of the Soviet Union would go their own way, and we still have Russia to deal with, but, you know, much smaller than the Soviet Union, much weaker. We had no way of knowing all that was coming. We had no way of knowing that the Berlin Wall was going to come down without a shot being fired. We had no way of knowing that we had outspent the Russians, outspent the Soviets, to the point where their whole productive infrastructure was collapsing in debt. We had no way of knowing that we were going to win the Cold War just a few years later. So in 1987, this TV miniseries was created called America, spelled with a K. And like I said, you can read about it and then watch the 13 episodes. Over a two-week period in 1987, it presented the idea that through a pretty bloodless coup d'etat, the Soviet Union and communism had been able to conquer the United States and actually occupy it. But not through a military invasion directly, but rather through subverting the political process and uniting the two primary political parties. And then, in almost an Orwellian sense, crushing the independent candidate, played by Kris Kristofferson, by the way, who rose up against the elite and the establishment. And by accusing him of being in collusion with the Russians, which is actually what they were doing themselves. Kind of like Hillary's campaign which was in collusion with the Russians and gave them our uranium, was in collusion with the Russians, but then blamed Trump for being exactly what she was. But as this miniseries develops, ultimately, it's discovered that the only way that the United States of America can escape from the domination of communism is by no longer being the United States of America. Literally, civic nationalists would face off against Balkanizers who wanted to break up the country into five separate geographic regions. One of them called Heartland, much like I wrote about in my Haste in the Day trilogy. And the focus on Heartland, the leader of which is played by Peter O'Rourke, is the core of the last few installments in this 13-part series on YouTube. So I encourage you to go to YouTube and invest the time. You know, a lot of people say that you should go to YouTube and watch The Greatest Story Never Told about World War II and Hitler and National Socialism, and that's cool. But to really understand the 21st century and what we are facing now with the death of America and the breakup of the United States and the struggle, most importantly, between civic nationalism that wants to hold the United States together and defeat our enemies in one lump sum, and between the Balkanizers like myself who want to have white ethnostates rise. You need to watch America with a K on YouTube. And what you'll see is that the well-meaning, good-intentioned nobility of civic nationalism is a dead end. It's a failure. And even in 1987, over 30 years ago, the analogy, the parable of our nation being conquered by communism is only interesting from one perspective, because you can look at how it actually happened compared to how they portrayed that it might have happened. Because rest assured that it happened. Whether it's by the Soviet Union or not, enemies foreign or domestic, the United States was conquered. It's a dead deal, and it needs to be buried. So go to YouTube and watch America with a K, the 13-part episodes of a TV miniseries from 1987, My Youth. And remember that Balkanization is not a bad thing. The rise of white ethnostates is the best thing that can happen for our people. The worst thing that can happen is for civic nationalism to conquer us, and for the United States to remain together, and for people to keep thinking that they can vote their way out of this mess and just choose the right candidate and put their hopes in him as being our guy. Now, a couple of final thoughts. Polar bears are on the way to extinction, according to recent news reports. Apparently, global warming, whether you believe it or not, has weakened and thinned some of the polar ice sheets, and so the polar bears are having trouble getting to the cute little fuzzy sea lions that they eat. You know, nobody wants the polar bears to starve to death, but nobody wants to watch them eat a baby seal, do they? Right? Everybody's such a hypocrite. Well, the reality is the polar bears are maybe not getting as many baby seals, and I'm not sure if that's an effect of global warming or just natural selection. The reality is, you know, it was only a few dozen thousand years ago that a bunch of grizzly bears in northern Canada got lost and wandered north, and over successive generations they adapted to the whiteout ice and snow environment they found themselves in by, guess what, becoming white. The ones with gray were not as successful as being hunters, and so the whiter bears with patches of white and then with shades of white and then completely white were more successful hunters, so they got more food, so they bred more, reproduced more, and those white coat genes were passed on to the next generations. That's the way evolution works. And so eventually, this population of gray and black grizzly bears became white and became polar bears. All polar bears are is grizzly bears adapted to a polar environment, and they change the color of their coats. So what if now polar bears to survive have to move back south. Now, is race just a social construct? Does that mean that polar bears really don't matter because they're just grizzly bears with different color coats? Have they had time to develop other different physical and intellectual traits aside from the color of their coats? I doubt it. It's not like human races where our skin color is the least of our differences. Pretty much, polar bears and grizzly bears are the same except for the color of their coats. So, people are shrieking about these polar bears becoming endangered when really, all they're going to have to do is move back south and turn gray again. Unfortunately, in the human species, we don't have that alternative. It's not quite so easy. It's not as if whites could develop more melanin and everything could be cool. It's not as if blacks could lose some melanin and we'd all be equals. Racial differences between the different subspecies of the human species are much more than just skin color. They go all the way to the bone. And from the tip of our toes to the tips of our nose and everywhere in between. Most especially in terms of our abilities and proclivities towards building or destroying civilization. In that regard, we don't have much in common with the polar bears. But I don't really worry about global warming. I think that probably I'm smarter than the average bear, and I'll get along just fine. Now, next week on the Rope Report, I've been asked to discuss more about psychology and my views of gender relations, whether we're all hardwired into being who and what we are, or whether there's some shades of gray, some opportunity for slide down the spectrum. It really began when I talked about gender relations and the role of women in the movement in my podcast entitled A Divorce Proposal. And so I've received emails asking me to delve more into my beliefs about gender relations. It's something that's important to both men and women. So when we talk about gender and sex behavior, I encourage you to prepare for next week's broadcast by reading Desmond Morris's The Naked Ape and getting some thin skin, because I'm probably going to offend both some NGTOWs as well as some third and fourth wave feminists with the things that I have to say about gender relations. But I want you to take away from this podcast, from this week, that ultimately, being organic migrants is more important than being a white nationalist, because people's worldview, their political and racial views, can be molded by us as long as their genes survive. And forcing people to only accept your solution is no solution at all. It's certainly not organic or natural. And to try that is really swimming upstream against the current of what is already organically and naturally happening. And to remember that not all of us are going to be unified in the same big tent. We're all not going to fit together, and that's really okay. Until next time, this is Billy Roper for The Rope Report, reminding you as always to think racially, act locally, but no matter what, keep it white.
Can you hear the student band? I think they're getting out of hand. Well, you know what happened to those who complain? We've got to stop them seeing light. Let them think it's all right, 'cause the fire outside to keep them entertained. Well, the wells have not run dry. Do we really need to lie? We'll say it's a national emergency. We're at a wedding full of clowns, and we'll kick them while they're down. Get the banks control, 'cause they are France to me. Let's go and find a better place. We'll call it New America. Won't it be a lovely place to be? Imperial material, the mind of New America. The best idea since democracy.
Listening to Radio Aryan for an alternative to the anti-white system on RadioAryan.com.